Welcome to the Identity Trust Pulse, where we bring you the latest insights and trends from the fraud and identity industry. First-party fraud has been a significant concern in recent years and is more critical than ever for organizations to improve their ability to identify it, enhancing their understanding of consumer intent and the reasons why first-party fraud happens is a first step towards helping to prevent the downstream impacts, including fraudulent disputes and chargebacks. I'm your host, Lexi Lee, and I'm joined today by Nick DeLeonardis, VP of Data Science at LexisNexis Risk Solutions. Together, we'll discuss recent research and findings that provide a more robust view of consumers and share how forward-looking organizations can improve their approach to tackling first-party fraud. In the last few years, there's been a concerted effort from the Federal Reserve in partnership with cross industries to standardize inconsistent classifications of fraud. Yet, first-party fraud remains one of the most ambiguous types of frauds. To start, Nick, can you help define for our listeners what first-party application fraud is?
Thanks, Lexi, and excited to be here. That's probably a good jumping off point. First and foremost, first-party fraud is a nuance where the fraudster is using their own identity or the vast majority of their personal identifiable information to commit fraud, often referred to as intentional misuse. But make no mistake, they are misrepresenting their obligations or lying. When I reference obligations, they're misrepresenting their obligation to repay on, say, a device financing in telecommunications or in terms of a credit obligation as it relates to a loan. Now, there are a number of different types of first-party fraud. There could be a manipulated identity scenario where a consumer is trying to elude their bad credit history by augmenting aspects of their personally identifiable information, such as using a CPN number in place of a Social Security number. Other types of first-party fraud that exist, such as muling, that is a scenario that is really across multiple industries. We've seen it in the telecommunication industry and also in financial services. There's also situations such as a phenomenon referred to as loan stacking, where consumers will stack up and apply for multiple loans in a very short period of time, and in many cases, eluding detection of that rapid velocity. But make no mistake, they are misrepresenting, again, going back to not having that intent to repay.
And if we can maybe look at the spectrum of the different fraud types, just in comparison to where first-party fraud stands or compares, there's synthetic identity, where we often talk about proof of life, right? And so that's relatively cleaner to detect because we can look at the public record profile or footprints across, establishment of identities, whether it's from SSNs or from home addresses reported by utility companies, or even bureau records, where we may have certain indicators of when they first appeared and how long they've been building up their public record history. And then when we think about stolen identities, you've actually got a victim that reports on, hey, my identity was stolen. It wasn't me who applied, right? It was somebody else. And it was pretty relatively easy or simple to detect compared to first-party fraud. So I just want to kind of share those other types of fraud profiles to help our readers or listeners get a better grasp of the different behaviors that vary across these types.
Lexi, that's a great point. And it's really important to emphasize the differences across the types of fraud and to understand the problem or type of fraud before you start building the solutions. We've seen a myriad of different types of profiles when differentiating, say, a first-party fraud from a synthetic fraud and even a stolen identity, as Lexi had described.
And ultimately, what that means for an organization is how they treat those high-risk identity frauds, right? The way that they treat synthetics will differ from the way they treat a stolen identity and from how they may proceed with a first-party fraud. Is that a good understanding, Nick?
That's certainly the case. You won't necessarily have the same type of, as they refer to, fraud remediation across the different types of problems. And to that point is why we recommend at LexisNexis Risk Solutions to be able to define and clearly understand your problems before jumping into solutions.
And first-party fraud has been a well-known, growing and prevalent problem across many industries. As you mentioned, right, across financial services, market lending, telecommunications, auto lending, et cetera. What is the impact of first-party application fraud for organizations?
I'll start out by saying that we've seen an increase across all industries in terms of first-party fraud, transactional in terms of financial relationships, transactional fraud, telecommunication, first-party fraud, auto, even demand deposit accounts, checking and savings accounts. And then, of course, your traditional lending products such as credit cards and personal loans. As it relates to the cost in terms of the industry, from our true cost of fraud report, we are seeing over $4 cost to organizations for every dollar loss. So that's a huge burden that it's putting on the institutions as it relates to the impact to the industry. Many will refer to first-party fraud as a recessionary fraud. And as we think about some of the macroeconomic factors such as higher interest rates, reduced stimulus or income for consumers, we could see an even larger increase in first-party fraud as consumers are almost painted into a corner and not have the options to repay loans, and they may turn to more nefarious behaviors such as first-party fraud. We do see that. That's been a trend in some of these economic dips where we do again see an increase in first-party fraud.
And from the financial services or organizational perspective, they're under pressure from a lending resource perspective to also be extra due diligent about who they lend to, right? Who they potentially be extending that service or credit to because interest rates are high. So, you know, the cost of getting financing just to run, you know, the businesses or the industries that they're in, those rates also go up. So it's extra costly for organizations who have to deal with these elusive first-party frauds, plus, as you said, right, the onset and the rise of consumers who may not have many options, and they may become more susceptible to transacting these types of frauds.
Exactly. When you have low interest rates, margins aren't as thin. You don't see this problem as much as we are in a little bit more of a tighter growth economy, more challenges for the consumer. These situations are exacerbated.
Within the fraud prevention communities, you know, we made substantial strides in detecting and safeguarding against the stolen synthetic identities, as we mentioned before. What is it about a first-party fraud that just makes it so much more challenging to detect?
Several things are going on here. Number one, as mentioned, it's on the rise. So you're just really, you are seeing just a larger burden on institutions. Number two, it's hard to defend against. And we touched upon this a moment ago. Once you identify that a transaction or a credit application is with a high degree of confidence of first-party fraud, the question then becomes, what type of review or remediation do you send them through? As example, in knowledge-based authentication just is not the appropriate mechanism and tool for this type of fraud. There may require document authentication or just sending for further review if you do have a business that has in branch, in retail store option. But that becomes very costly from a application breakage standpoint. So you need to be mindful of the scenarios where you're putting those applications through additional scrutiny. And lastly, it's hard to discern. Difficulty understanding whether a credit bad is truly a distressed consumer who has the inability to repay. They've applied for credit or applied for device financing, and they found themselves in challenging situations and cannot repay. Discerning that consumer from the true first-party fraud becomes challenging. Now, we have taken a unique approach, we believe, whereby we can decouple the type of bads or defaults on your portfolio through an extensive type of decomposition signal analysis where we can see behaviors related to a first-party fraud versus a distressed consumer.
Let's talk more about that, actually. So my understanding is that our data science team at LexisNexis Risk Solutions has recently leveraged machine learning to profile a sample of never pay accounts. Now, what insights or profiles have we gleaned from this research to help organizations infer consumer intent?
Really, three core themes that have emerged when we decoupled, as you mentioned, Lexi, your early payment defaults. We had seen that there is low variation in your core personally identifiable fields: Social Security number, date of birth, and first and last name. Now, we do see some scenarios in manipulated identities where they are moving around the Social Security number. All intents and purposes, your first-party frauds have that core elements intact. Number two, velocity is key. Inquiries to new credit behavior as it relates to applying for a number of loans in a short period of time across various industries. So we will see inquiries that come through in credit card and then shortly thereafter on personal loan. And that's critical to be able to identify that in a unique network near real time. Lastly, the establishment of proof of life, which becomes the nuance between synthetic frauds and first-party fraud. Synthetic frauds typically have less proof of life, and that's been the core for identifying synthetic frauds, whereby with a first-party fraud, we are seeing established, i.e., as old of history in terms of a data footprint, 5 years or more, which is fairly well established as you think about fraudsters creating identities. Here we see that establishment, and we do see a little bit more address stability. So those core profiles are allowing us to be able to discern between the different types of fraud where we can identify this malicious first-party intent.
And when we think about velocity, I mean, that's really, you know, one of the bigger challenges is that first-party fraudsters may be shopping, right? They may be applying for different services across different companies at the same time or within seconds or minutes of each other. And organizations don't have a robust way of detecting and using sort of a block list or some sort of a high-risk indication to check against, they may not be able to detect these bursts of activities in time. And it seems like it's right for fraudsters to evade those defenses when they think about attacking organizations separately. However, if we think about a community or network phenomenon where organizations are more or less real time reporting these types of events or attacks, or even just transactions, and letting more sophisticated models sort of do the groundwork of crawling through and detecting those high risk behaviors, that seems to be better defense against these high velocity events that could occur from a first party fraud attack.
Yeah, it's a good point to drive home, Lexi. You're referencing what we refer to as our client contributed consortiums, and we have a number of near real-time consortiums that will span your digital transactions at a near real-time basis or the personally identifiable information as it comes through on these type of applications across industries. So you have that visibility to a loan stacking problem, to a consumer that is applying for a credit card at Bank A, and now shortly thereafter, moments, is applying for a credit card at Bank B. To have that visibility is critical when you're trying to identify first-party fraud.
And to lean into that, you know, how can organizations improve the detection and prevention of first-party application fraud while maintaining and really protecting that enhanced customer experience for legitimate or trusted consumers?
Number one, as mentioned, consider consortiums for the near real-time behavior as well the feedback that consortiums provide you. Oftentimes, a consortium will have performance feedback to say, well, this transaction or this PII or device had this negative behavior a month ago, 3 months ago, and so on. Number two, understanding your fraud attacks and to align the strategy. We talked a little bit about this, Lexi, in terms of fraud is not monolithic and you can't treat all frauds the same. You need to have the appropriate strategy for a given type of fraud. Multi-layer approaches are critical. And when we reference a multi-layered approach, ensuring that you're evaluating for your, as they refer to, faceless channel, your device recognition, and any anomalies associated with that device, ensuring that you are scanning personally identifiable information, also ensuring that you have visibility into a public record domain to make sure that you can look into the proof of life for a particular transaction. And lastly, agility and efficiency, making sure that your tools are ideally centralized on a central location so that you can adjust your strategies, adjust your policy, and even your scores if possible in a relatively agile manner. Because as we know, fraudsters are very agile. We need to adhere to governance, compliance, and standard procedures, but we still can operate in an agile manner so as to be able to combat that agility the fraudsters are hitting us up against.
And to coming up to a close here, what is the most important defense for our listeners to understand about first-party fraud detection? The way that I'm looking at it is that fraud prevention is really a joint effort. And, you know, our customers can really benefit from understanding the community power, right? The power of being able to take advantage of the contributed performances and feedbacks from the network to then further enhance their own fraud prevention strategies.
It's number one, it's adapt, adapt, adapt. What worked yesterday won't necessarily be the same approach that works in the forthcoming months and years. So having that both a multi-layered approach, but also having the flexibility to move your strategies as behaviors are slightly changing is important. You think about over a decade ago, we didn't necessarily think of email address for a focal point of fraudsters to utilize. And now we're seeing that as a more pervasive tactic and approach whereby we can see that in particular consortiums. So that being an example of over time, the way we operate as consumers changes, our strategies change, and fraudsters are changing and adjusting. We need to adjust accordingly.
And post-pandemic, you know, we've seen a rise of, let's call it, you know, digital nomads, right? People who are able to work remote really from anywhere in the world. And so from a global perspective, we're seeing fraudsters penetrate across different geographies, across different industries, from a global ecosystem. And so it seems that to combat the rise of fraud, companies really need to look across the entire consumer journey and across geographies, being able to really tie that digital, those digital entities or devices, IPs, typical things that, you know, we have really seen a rise of in the last 5 years prior, but now it's just so prevalent across any interaction. And so that's another key aspect that companies need to consider, is that, you know, these defenses need to kind of span different boundaries physically and digitally.
Yeah, Lexi, it's a great point. We are observing increases in human fraud attacks across all the regions that we monitor, APAC, EMEA, Latin American markets, as well as your North American markets, all seeing double-digit increases in the human-initiated attacks. So you're spot on that it's important to look at your business on a global level. Now, I caveat, it certainly does depend upon your business model, but the way that we are operating as far as a consumer base and the way that businesses are spanning more globally, it's just so much more important to have that global visibility to some of this negative behavior and being able to identify it across multiple regions.
Well, thank you so much, Nick. I found this really insightful and I thoroughly enjoyed our conversation. Are there any closing remarks or key takeaways for our listeners?
Great discussion. I appreciate being on here, Lexi. Three key areas that I want to drive home. Number one is certainly that agility, or being nimble to operate against the fraud attacks. Number two certainly is the aspect of client-contributed consortiums, near real-time behavior, and the rich data that you get within a consortium. Lastly, to not think of your fraud as all frauds are the same, knowing that fraud is not monolithic and needs to be treated differently for the different types of fraud.
To our listeners, if you like more actionable insights on this topic, you can download the white paper, Seeking First-Party Application Fraud, using the link in the description. Thank you for listening, and make sure you tune again for another episode of the Identity Trust Pulse.
The information provided in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to and shall not be used as legal advice. The views and opinions expressed in this program are solely those of the speakers and don't necessarily reflect the views or position of LexisNexis Risk Solutions. LexisNexis Risk Solutions does not warrant that the information provided in this podcast is accurate or error-free.